1 Corinthians and chapter 9. I'm going to begin the reading from verse 1. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my workmanship in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to our food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife as the other apostles and the brother of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Do I say this on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was written for our sake because the ploughman should plough in hope and the thresher thresh in hope of a share of the crop. If we have sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap your material benefits? If others share this rightful claim upon you, do not we still more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing this to secure any such provision. For I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with a commission. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my preaching I make the gospel free of charge, not making full use of my right in the gospel. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not myself being under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being without the law towards God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. I do it for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Amen. It's my duty and my privilege to introduce Stephen Rees to you, who will give this evening's paper. Stephen is co-pastor of Grace Baptist Church in Stockport, and if my maths are correct, he's served that congregation now for 28 years, something in that region. I've been at Chorlton for nearly 27 years, and I have to say that during all of that time, or most of that time, from the near beginning of my ministry there, I've been grateful to the Lord as I've benefited from Stephen's serious and scholarly approach to Scripture. I remember long before I got to Chorlton, as I began my own first steps in preaching and teaching God's Word, I was overwhelmed by a great anxiety. How do I know I've got it right to teach and preach? How do I know I've got it right? There is such a thing as a cold sweat. Two great fears. The first one, and of course the greatest one, is that of misrepresenting God. And the consequence of that is the misleading of the people of God. Faulty exegesis leads to a flawed application. Who would be guilty of that? Our subject tonight, the one Stephen has chosen and we have agreed that he should speak on, and again tomorrow, is on the text that we've read from 1 Corinthians 9, all things to all men. And as Stephen will show, there's many a time that text has been handled badly, wrongly. But there is a right way to handle that particular text and to apply it rightly, correctly, and wisely, and helpfully. Stephen, please come and give the first of these two papers. Thank you.
We're turning to our subject, all things to all men. That's the second half of 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 22. Paul says, I have become all things to all men, so that by all means I may save some. It's a verse that's quoted very often these days by Christians and others. It's become a key text in all sorts of controversies and discussions among Christians. It's been used to justify almost every new approach to worship, every new method of evangelism, every new lifestyle that Christians have adopted in recent years. Preachers, missiologists, church growth experts, worship leaders, they all love to quote this text. Let me list out three ways in which this text is regularly used. Firstly, we're told on the basis of this text that we must be willing to adapt the message that we preach to fit with the people we're preaching to. We're told that we have to present a message that will resonate with people in the particular society that we're preaching to. It's got to be a message that they feel comfortable with. It's got to be a message that won't offend their cultural sensitivities. Here's one example. I've taken this from a web page written by a worthy brother, a man worthy of our respect. He's an elder in one of the Grace Baptist churches down in the south of England. And he says this, quote, it was Paul's proud boast, I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. If we follow Paul's example, we shall be accommodating to different age groups, cultures, and lifestyles. For instance, I read that the Japanese find it difficult to relate to the fatherhood of God, because fathers are rather remote figures in many Japanese families. It is very much the mother who takes responsibility for children. So it might be better to talk about the motherhood of God to Japanese. You understand, we become all things to all men, and that means we must be prepared to adapt our gospel message to fit that culture. At this moment in time, there's a furious controversy going on among mission organizations working among Muslims. There are some who hold the view that in preaching to Muslims, you should never refer to God as the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ. And you should never speak of Jesus as the Son of God. Why? Because in Muslim culture, that is unacceptable. It will be misunderstood. So the Wycliffe translators, for example, currently have about 30 or 40 Bible translations in which they have removed all reference to Jesus as the Son of God or to his Father. So in those translations, the word Son, for example, might be translated as representative. And the word Father might be translated as guardian. In one of those translations, Jesus' command to his disciples to baptize in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit becomes baptize in the name of God and his Messiah and the Holy Spirit. And why do they need to do this? Because we must be prepared to become all things to all men. When we're speaking to Muslims, we must think and speak in terms acceptable to Muslims. So that's the first thing. We must modify what we actually say to people when we're preaching the gospel, if we want to be all things to all men. And then secondly, we're told that we must adapt our evangelistic methods in order to reach folk from different societies and cultures. We've got to be ready to use whatever methods will sit most easily with the people we're dealing with. So this is Mark Driscoll's take on this verse. He refers to this verse and then he says, if he was alive today, Paul would say to the indie rockers, I did indie rock. To the hip hoppers, I did hip hop. To the tech guys, I had a blog. For the families, I talked about marriage and kids and parenting. For the business guys, I did financial seminars and connected it back to God. For the environmental rights activists, I told them who the Creator was, since they enjoy his work so much. I tried to figure out how to articulate Jesus in as many ways as I possibly could, to as many people as I possibly can, to win as many people as are possible. Here's another example. This is a well-known Christian writer, blogger, speaker. She says, I believe it is acceptable to preach the gospel in all ways that produce good fruit for the kingdom of God. Song, dance, drama, pantomime, books, comic books, magazines, tracts, preaching, teaching, movie clips, counseling, and all the other creative ways that man can come up with to proclaim Christ and make disciples for him. The Apostle Paul said, I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. Paul's goal was converts, and he was willing to do whatever it took to make that happen. Now, those two writers are typical of very many Christians today. They're both talking about evangelistic methods. And they say we use whatever methods will help us communicate with people from a particular culture. And it's this verse that they use to prove their point. And then thirdly, other Christian leaders are keen to add that it's not just evangelism where we've got to be all things to all men. They're keen to say that we must also use this as a guiding principle when we're deciding how we're going to worship and how the church should be organized. This is Derek Tidball, Baptist pastor and lecturer in pastoral theology at London Bible College, as it then was. He points to this verse, and then he says this, Paul's principle deserves more serious attention because there is an urgent need for the church to live by it. Given her present weak situation, it is as much a statement about Paul's pastoral practice as his evangelistic technique. For Dr. Tidball, the trouble is, quote, that instead of becoming all things to all men, we expect all men to become one thing. That is just like us. Our converts have to fit into our mold, to learn our language, adopt our culture, and become clones of believers who have been in the church for a long time. And he says, it is precisely here that Paul's statement needs to be heard afresh. Do they have to dress in a certain way? Does it mean worship at 11 and 6:30? Do they have to have a leather-bound Bible? Have they got to learn to like certain types of church music and choirs which seem very foreign to them? Can they worship without flowers at the front of the church? Have they got to break off all their previous contacts? And it is a pastoral necessity that we learn again to become all things to all men, not only for the sake of their initial response to the gospel, but also for the sake of their nurture and growth in the gospel. So he's arguing that this verse applies as much to what goes on in our churches, the way we worship, the way we relate to one another, the way we dress for our meetings, whether we have flowers in our church building. It relates to all those things as much as it does to our evangelism. Basically, what he's saying is that when we ask questions about how we organize life in our churches, we should never ask, what are we used to? What is traditional among us? What are we comfortable with? We should ask, what will people from the society around be comfortable with? What will be familiar to them? What will match their culture? What does that mean in practice for the churches represented here? Well, here's the view of one man, a GBM missionary for many years, who then became one of our best-known mission strategists. And this is from a talk he gave at the Grace Baptist Assembly. First of all, he pictures some of our churches which, quote, concentrate on keeping themselves as a kind of spiritual ghetto, preserving unchanged, much-loved patterns of the past. The language used in their meetings often including arcane terminology, will not be that in common use in the streets today. Their hymns will be strictly from the 17th and 18th centuries. The style of their meeting will be that of 100 years ago and always restricted to a monologue preaching. But he says, in contrast with that, there are some churches which are grappling with the concept of biblical change. And how is that done? He answers, by observing the Pauline principles of Christian communication. And where do we find them? Well, of course, it's this passage he turns to. And so he argues that on the basis of this verse, all things to all men, we've got to phase out the old Victorian hymns. We've got to get rid of the authorized version. And so on and so forth. We've got to modernize our churches. Though he adds, we ought to do it gently for the sake of older folk. Now notice here, he's not talking about our evangelistic activities. Just like the last man I quoted, he's talking about life in the church. What hymns we sing. What Bible translation we use in our meetings. Whether we have what he calls monologue preaching. In other words, a man standing up to give an extended talk from the Bible. And what he's saying is that we need to change the way we do all these things in the church, because we've got to be all things to all men. We've got to do things in our churches in a way that will reflect the culture around us. The reason we've got to get rid of our monologue preaching is because that isn't the way people communicate in 21st century Britain. And the proof text for all of this again is 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 22. Now notice, I'm not commenting at this point on any of the things that any of these writers are pushing for. I've not said whether I think we should speak of God as mother rather than father when we're talking to Japanese people. I've not said whether I think we should use hip-hop or drama as evangelistic methods. I've not said whether we should have flowers in church or not, or whether we should use the authorized version or not. I've not commented on any of those things. I may finish up agreeing or disagreeing with all of those writers about some or all of the things that they want to see changing. But there is one thing on which I disagree with them all. I disagree with their use of 1 Corinthians 9:22. Because when I read that verse in its context, The one thing that's blatantly obvious is that it's not about adapting the message we preach. It's not about changing our evangelistic methods. It's not about reforming the way we worship or what we do in our church meetings. Paul is talking here about one thing, his personal lifestyle. The way he dresses, what he eats, the way he finances himself. When people try to use this verse to discuss the content of our preaching, or the evangelistic methods we use, or the way that church life should be structured, they are misusing the passage. Just glance with me at 1 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. What is chapter 8 all about? It's about the question of whether Christians were free to eat meat that had previously been sacrificed in honour of idols. There'd be these sacrifices in the temples, and then the meat from the sacrifices would be sold off in the market. Were Christians? Was it in order for Christians to buy and eat that meat? That was a real question for Christians in Corinth. And even more acute was the question of whether they could go into the pagan temples and join in the feasts that were actually held there. Let's say a group of businessmen were holding a meal in the temple. Could you go with your fellow businessmen and join in the meal in the pagan temple? Now, those are questions of personal lifestyle. It's nothing to do with what message we should preach to the unconverted. It's nothing to do with our evangelistic methods. It's nothing to do with how we organise our activities in the local church. The Corinthian Christians weren't saying that they wanted to eat meat in pagan temples as a form of evangelism. Nobody was suggesting that holding feasts in honour of idols should be part of the church meetings. This was simply a question of what you can and can't do as a Christian living your life from day to day. And the Corinthian Christians, or some of them at least, were saying, we've got the right to buy food that's being sold in the market, food that's being offered to idols. And for the matter, some of them were saying, we've got the right to go into the pagan temples and eat there. We know that the meat is just meat. It won't harm us. We know that the idol is just a block of wood. It can't affect us. So when we do these things, we're exercising our Christian freedom. These things are legitimate. That's the question. What is legitimate as part of Christian lifestyle? And it's that question that Paul is answering in chapters 8 and 9. He's happy to agree with the Christians who were saying that meat offered to idols was just meat. It was perfectly wholesome food. Buying a lump of meat in the market from an animal that had been sacrificed in a pagan temple, eating that meat isn't going to bring a curse on you. He agrees with them that an idol is just a block of wood that can't harm anyone. A Christian who walks into a pagan temple, a Christian who's employed, or he does a builder repairing a pagan temple and has to go into it, isn't somehow automatically damaging his soul. Every time Paul walks through the marketplace in any Greek city, he's walking past idols. If they really emanated some soul-destroying rays, some demonic power, they'd harm Paul as he walked past them, wouldn't he? So in that sense, these Corinthians are right. Eating meat offered to idols, even going into a pagan temple, could in some circumstances be legitimate things to do. But is it right for the Corinthians to do them? That's another question. And Paul's answer is plain. Not if it's going to harm others. Not if it's going to be a stumbling block to other Christians. Not if it's going to send out a false signal to unbelievers. You may have the right to do these things, but that doesn't make them right to do. In such matters of personal lifestyle, Christians have to be prepared to forfeit their rights for the sake of others. And then in chapter 9, Paul reminds the Corinthians that that's what he has to do all the time. There are all sorts of things that Paul has a perfect right to do. There are lifestyles that he would have a perfect right to choose, but which he's willing to forfeit. He's willing to forfeit them for the sake of the people he's trying to reach with the gospel. He says he's got the right to eat and drink. That's in verse 4. In other words, he's got the right to ask the churches to provide him with what he needs to live on. But he doesn't claim that right. Instead, he usually chooses to do a manual job to support himself. He's got the right to get married, he says, and then take his wife with him wherever he goes. And he doesn't claim that right, verse 5. Why not? Because verse 9, we're willing to endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. For the sake of others, the people he's trying to reach with the gospel, he's prepared to forgo his rights when it comes to matters of personal lifestyle. That's what he means when he says in verse 19, though I am free from all, I've made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. He's free from all, he says. No one's got the right to tell him that he's got to support himself financially. And no one's got a right to tell him that he must accept a salary for his gospel work. No one has the right to tell him he must get married or that he mustn't get married. He's reminded them back in verse 1. He's an apostle. He's got supreme authority under Christ. One church commissioned him, but he's not answerable to any church. He's got authority beyond that of any church. So no one, Christian or non-Christian, can dictate to Paul in matters of personal lifestyle. And yet he says, I've made myself a servant to all. Instead of asking, what are my needs? What will suit me best? He asks at every point, what will be best for other people? And especially the people I'm trying to reach with the gospel. In all these matters of personal lifestyle, he's prepared to forget his own interests, his own preferences. He'll do whatever is best for others. So he says, to the Jews, or for the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. In what sense did he become a Jew? Is he saying that he altered the content of his preaching so that it wouldn't offend Jews? Well, if he had done that, there would never have been a circumcision controversy, would there? Is he saying that he alters the methods of his evangelism so that instead of preaching and debating, he organises evangelistic Passover meals or organises traditional Jewish dances adapted to communicate the gospel? Well, it's hardly that, is it? Is he saying that he makes sure that in the churches he plants, nothing is done that clashes with Jewish traditions? No, he's talking about his personal lifestyle. When he's entering a Jewish home, he's prepared to go through the traditional ritual washings. As a Christian, he's free to abandon them. But he doesn't. If he's inviting a Jew to eat with him, he serves food that conforms to Jewish rules of purity. If he goes into a synagogue, he dresses in a way that will seem respectful and appropriate to the people who are there. He says, for those under the law, he became as if he were one under the law. By the law, he means the commandments that were laid down by Moses as rules for Jewish people to keep, and then all the Jewish traditions that had grown up around them. Well, Paul says, I myself, I'm not under that law. I'm not bound to keep all those commands about clean and unclean food, and about clothes made of mixed fibres, and about washings, and about treating festival days with respect. But I still do keep those rules when I'm mixing with Jewish people, if I think that breaking them would make it harder to reach those people with the gospel. And likewise, Paul says, to those outside the law, to Gentiles, I became as one outside the law. You know, if Paul goes into a Gentile home, they're likely to serve all sorts of food that the law would have banned for Jewish folk. Food that Paul has been conditioned to think of as disgusting. Prawns. Pork. Sweetbreads. He's free to refuse it. No one can tell him he's got to eat such food. But if he's in a Gentile community, trying to reach Gentiles with the gospel, he'll adopt Gentile ways when it comes to personal lifestyle. Because he cares about those people. And he's prepared to sacrifice all his own personal preferences in order to reach them with the gospel. Notice I'm being careful with my words. He's prepared to sacrifice all his personal preferences. He's quick to add, that doesn't mean he can adopt any Jewish practice or any Gentile practice. He says in the second half of verse 21, I'm not outside the law of God. The laws that God had given for all nations, the laws that were there from creation and then were reinforced in the Ten Commandments, they're non-negotiable as far as Paul is concerned. He's not going to break them in order to keep Jews or Gentiles happy. Paul's going to keep a Sabbath wherever he's living, because it was laid down at creation that a man labours for 6 days and then sets aside the seventh as holy. Paul may choose marriage or singleness. But even if he's working in a polygamous community, he won't choose polygamy, because God said from the beginning, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his one wife, and they become one flesh. Paul is free to choose between two legitimate lifestyles. He's not free to break God's law. But he is under Christ's law, he says. Whatever choices he makes for himself, when it comes to his personal lifestyle preferences, he's going to remember Christ's law, that he's to love his neighbour as himself. When it comes to personal lifestyle, he's going to do what is best for others, within the constraints of God's unchanging law. Now, that's Paul's attitude. And he talks about it in chapter 9 because he wants it to be the attitude of the Corinthians too. Now, of course, their situation is slightly different from Paul's. Most of them aren't evangelists or missionaries travelling from one city to another, trying to reach all sorts of different communities. When Paul sacrifices his own freedom for the sake of others, it's non-Christians he's thinking about particularly. I become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel. But when he tells the Corinthians that they must sacrifice their freedoms for the sake of others, the others he's thinking of are particularly their fellow Christians, their fellow church members. He tells them in chapter 8, verse 12, that if they make selfish lifestyle choices, they'll be sinning against their brothers and wounding their consciences. Chapter 8, verse 13, if food makes my brother stumble, I'll never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. So Paul is willing to forego his rights in order to win outsiders. So surely the Corinthians can at least forego their rights in order to protect their fellow believers. Of course, most of the time we've got to keep both those objectives in view, haven't we? Paul was concerned first and foremost to be sensitive to outsiders, but he also had to think about the needs of believers within the church. The Corinthians had to be concerned first and foremost about their fellow believers, but they also had to think about the impact their lifestyle had on the outsiders. And that's true for most of us, perhaps all of us, as believers. In all our lifestyle choices, we're asking, one, what impact will this have on our fellow church members? Will it help them to live godly, happy lives in the church? And we're asking, two, what impact will this have on the unbelievers we're in contact with? Will it make it easier or harder for them to listen to the gospel and take it seriously? And that's the challenge of 1 Corinthians 9:22. I wonder if we take it seriously. Let's run through some different issues, just as examples of what we're talking about. Let's think first about the sort of lifestyle issues where a Christian needs to think about the way that his or her choices will affect his brothers or sisters in the church. I'm going to give you four areas where you've got to think about how your lifestyle choices impact on your fellow church members. And we'll label them A, B, C, and D. Category A. There are issues where the danger is that one Christian, by his behaviour, pressures another Christian into doing things that are against that Christian's conscience. That was particularly what troubled Paul about the Corinthians eating meat offered to idols. But for us, alcohol, watching films, having a TV set, well, there are lots of things that come into that category. So, you may be convinced that drinking alcohol is a perfectly legitimate thing for a Christian to do. And you have every right to open a bottle of wine when you've got some friends from the church round for a meal. But among them, there's that young student who was brought up in a very different sort of Christian background. He's been taught that all drinking is wrong for Christians. And he's promised his parents that he won't drink while he's away from home. But as you fill up the glasses, he's being put in a very difficult position. He doesn't want to cause a fuss. He doesn't want to seem holier than thou. He doesn't want to be the odd one out. He doesn't want to feel embarrassed. So he finishes up drinking with you. And for him, it's sin. It's against his conscience. And you put him in that position. Was it necessary for you to do that? Was it necessary for you to serve wine without finding out first if all the guests would be comfortable with that? And when you realised that he wasn't, wouldn't it have been kinder to say, oh, actually, I think I'd prefer fruit juice myself. Just so that he wouldn't feel the odd one out. Being all things to all men sometimes means being a teetotaler to teetotalers, even if you feel free to drink. A non-TV watcher to non-TV watchers, even if you feel free to have a TV set. A non-cinema goer to non-cinema goers, even if you're convinced that these things are completely legitimate for you. Category B. We need to think about the sorts of issues where the danger is that your lifestyle tempts other Christians to unhelpful reactions and feelings. Think, for example, about money. Within a real gospel church, there will be some rich people, relatively at least, and there will be some people who are struggling financially. There will be some people who eat out at restaurants every week, and there'll be others who queue down at the local supermarket to snap up the date-expiring items at the end of the day. Let's say you're from one of the richer families. And it's time to replace the family car, as opposed to the four runarounds that different members of the family drive. Do you have the right to replace it with the new souped-up Boggs Triumphant that does 0 to 180 in 9 seconds and does 7 miles to the gallon? Yes, you have that right. You have the right to arrive at church in that car and to take up 3 spaces in the car park. It's your money. It's been entrusted to you by the Lord, and you are free to use it in that way. Nobody has the right to tell you you can't. And maybe that is the right car for you to buy. Maybe that is the one car that actually meets your needs in terms of your work and your family. And if that is so, then buy it and thank God that you're in a position to do so. But think very carefully before you make the choice. What impact is it going to have on your brother, your Christian brother, who is desperately wondering how he's going to get his 14-year-old banger through the MOT? Oh, sure, he ought to be able to rejoice in your prosperity. If he were a perfectly holy man, no doubt he would be contented with what he has and just be glad that you've got something better. But churches aren't made up of perfectly holy men. They're made up of people who can be tempted to discontent, to envy, to covetousness, to bitterness. Is it really necessary to expose your brother to those temptations? Could you look for a car that's a little less ostentatious, that doesn't shout out the difference between you and your brother quite as loudly? Isn't that what becoming all things to all men means? To the man who lives without flashy cars, I became a man who lives without flashy cars. But maybe you're one of the less well-off people in the church. You're always having to scrape and save. You get your clothes from charity shops when they have their end-of-season sale. And you get your furniture off Freecycle. And you go on about it. Because it's actually quite exciting, you know, getting those bargains. And you're always talking about the lengths you have to go to get by. Do you have the right to do that? Of course you do. You've got the right to talk about anything you like, providing that you're telling the truth. But have you thought about the impact it might have on the people who don't have to live like that, your brothers and sisters, and who frankly don't have the time to live like that? You know, it takes time to do a round of the charity shops looking for bargains. Your fellow Christian may have more money than you do, but he may also have a demanding 13-hour-a-day job that doesn't leave him any time for your money-saving lifestyle. But when you're talking about how you've got to live the life you do, perhaps you're making him feel guilty about the fact that he does just save time by ordering his suits made to measure from the tailor. Perhaps you're stopping him from relaxing and enjoying his well-deserved holiday when he heads off to the sunshine with his family. Is that kind? Do you have to do it? Is it fair to make him embarrassed about the fact that the Lord has given him a different lifestyle from yours? Doesn't this verse apply to you as well as to him? Category C. Issues where your lifestyle choices drive a wedge between you and the other Christians in a church and spoil the unity of the church. And there are all sorts of things you can think of that fall into that category. Let's talk about hobbies. It's a group of folk in the church who share a common enthusiasm, whether it's hill walking or computer programming or black and white movies or whatever. And nobody in that church, at least, would suggest that there was anything unlawful in any of those pursuits. But there are a lot of people in the church who haven't got the faintest interest in them. Well, the people who are excited by those things, they gravitate to one another. They're in contact with each other all the time. They're talking constantly. They're exchanging emails. They're just enjoying their hobby together. And others in the church feel more and more excluded because they don't understand the jargon. And they can't latch on to the in-jokes. And they can't be part of it all. This little group of hill walkers or Scottish psalm-singing buffs or whatever it may be are becoming a clique, a church within a church. I think Paul would say it's time for some of the people in that church to put aside their rights. It may be that everyone in the church has to put aside their rights. It may be that some of the folk who have exercised their right not to go off on hikes in the Peak District will say, well, to stay in touch with my brothers and sisters, I'll go with them on their next walk, even though I think it's going to bore me stiff. But frankly, whether it's hill walking or going to concerts at the Bridgewater or going to creationist conferences or whatever it might be, the majority of hobbies are things that most people in the church can't get involved in, which means that if anyone is going to give way, it's going to be the people who are devoted to those things. If they find that their hobby is dividing the church, then they're going to have to look for a new hobby, one that everyone in the church can get involved in. It might even be something like coming to the prayer meeting or helping with the church cleaning. Being all things to all men sometimes means becoming a non-chess player for the sake of the non-chess players. And then category D, the areas that we call cultural. The areas which the issues which spring from the fact that churches, if they're real churches, do bring together people from different racial and cultural and social backgrounds. And those people have different sensitivities and different expectations. Again, that was what had caused the tension in Corinth, the fact that you had Jewish and Gentile people together in the church. And some of the things that Jewish people did, some of their habits and traditions, frankly made Gentile people feel uncomfortable. And some of the things that the Gentiles in the church did, as a matter of course, made Jewish people feel uncomfortable. Even when one group could see that the other group had the right to live as they did, it still made them feel uncomfortable. And that's still true today. Just to use Paul's example of food. If a man is converted from a Pakistani Muslim background, he may very soon grasp the truth that through Christ all foods have become clean. He knows now that there's nothing wrong with eating pork. But even though he knows that, if he goes to a barbecue at a fellow Christian's home and they push a pork sausage hot dog into his hand, he is likely to feel very squeamish because he's been conditioned to think of pigs as disgusting, filthy animals. Does an English-born Christian have the right to serve pork at a barbecue? Sure we do. But there are times when we say to the ex-Muslim, I become an ex-Muslim. I wouldn't dream of doing it, you say. You can think of any number of other examples. Taking Paul's words seriously means that we really work at understanding the different cultural sensitivities of different people within the church. And we are really willing to sacrifice our own freedom so that we're not making them feel uncomfortable. And that may apply to the way we dress, or the way that we show our affection to our wife publicly, or the question of whether we let the dog in the house when we've got visitors. It may apply to anything where different cultures have generated different sensitivities. So we're in the same position as the Corinthians. There are all sorts of lifestyle issues where we need to think about the way our choices will affect our brothers and sisters in the church. But we're also in the same position as Paul. There are also lots of lifestyle issues where we need to ask how our choices will affect our witness to outsiders, to unbelievers. Obviously, many of the same things apply. You could go through each of our four categories, and you can see how they work out in our dealings with unbelievers. I've said we sacrifice legitimate things if by doing them we're pressurising fellow Christians to do things against their conscience. Yeah? But equally, we sacrifice legitimate things if by doing them we seem to be condoning the sinful lifestyles that non-Christians adopt. That was one of the problems when the Corinthians ate food that had previously been offered to idols. For them it was just food. But when non-Christians saw them eating it, those non-Christians thought, ah, so these Christians have got no problems with idol worship. Well, in just the same way, let's give an example. Watching a game of football may be fine for you. For you, it's just a good game. But maybe you're living among neighbours who are utterly obsessed with the game, for whom it's their idol. And you've got to ask yourself then, am I giving these people the impression that the idol they're worshipping is safe and innocent? And if so, mightn't it be better just to distance myself completely from their idol? And the same applies to any of the things that the world turns into idols. Again, we've got to ask ourselves, will the choices I'm making provoke sinful reactions, sinful feelings among non-Christian folk? We've got to ask ourselves, will my lifestyle choices drive unnecessary wedges between myself and my non-Christian associates? We've got to ask ourselves whether our lifestyle choices are offending the cultural sensitivities of non-Christians around us. Just to expand on that one for a moment, I said that if you're inviting friends from the church around, and they include ex-Muslims, you might be wise to avoid serving pork sausages at the barbecue. But that applies even more, doesn't it? If you're inviting neighbours around to spend an evening in the garden, non-Christian neighbours, and they include folk who are still Muslims, and it would probably be wiser for the women of the household not to be wearing shorts on that occasion. For that matter, if you live in a neighbourhood where there are a lot of conservative Muslims, and if you want them to take the gospel seriously, it would probably be wise for the women of the household to dress very modestly at any time, to cover up more than we would usually consider necessary in our culture. Do we want to confirm the impression that Christianity takes female modesty and purity less seriously than Islam does? Everything we've said about cultural sensitivities among Christians applies equally or more to the cultural sensitivities of non-Christians. Remember, we're not talking here about the message we preach or about the methods we use to communicate the gospel or the way we worship. We're not saying that we modify any of those things to keep people from different cultures happy. We're talking here about personal lifestyle choices, situations where you can make the choice between equally legitimate alternatives. And Paul is telling us that if we are serious about reaching others with the gospel, we will be asking all the time, not what is best for me, not what do I enjoy most, but what will make it easiest for these people to listen to the gospel and embrace it? And that often involves adopting other people's cultural norms, providing that the cultural norms you're adopting are themselves good and wholesome. It means at the very least showing that you understand and respect their customs. So in the end, taking Paul's words seriously is going to affect every part of our life and every lifestyle choice we make, where we live, what sort of house we live in, how that house is decorated, what we spend our money on, how we dress, what clubs we join, what hobbies we pursue. If you're a man, whether you shave or wear a beard. I used to wear a beard until I realized that it made it difficult for hard of hearing people to catch what I was saying. They couldn't lip read me. I rather liked my beard. And a Christian certainly free to grow a beard. But for me, becoming all things for all men meant shaving off my beard. Paul calls himself an apostle in chapter 9, verse 1. But what does he call himself in chapter 9, verse 9? Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave. For everyone. He's emphatic. He doesn't belong to anyone. As a slave, he doesn't belong to anyone but Christ. But as he is Christ's slave, he is willing to serve anyone whom Christ brings across his path. And the way he serves them is that with every lifestyle choice he makes, he asks, not what is best for me, but what is best for them. And he's asking us if we're prepared to do the same. My problem with some of those writers I was quoting at the beginning is that they make things too easy. It's relatively easy, isn't it, to throw out our Victorian hymns? It's relatively easy to organise Christian rock concerts to reach the unconverted. If that's what this verse was about, it wouldn't be very demanding. But if it's about becoming a slave, living for Christ, and living our daily lives for the good of the people we're placed among, then it becomes painful. The question we've got to ask ourselves is, are we ready for that? Thank you, Walter.